Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
There's video of this exchange. That YouTube link is in the description box of the show. We talk a lot about mental health and the mind. I was given an article that I shared on our social media pages about bad therapy. I've got Dr. Eugene Botnov. He is a licensed clinical psychologist and a professor at Pennsylvania State University, York. I've got Dr. Alexander Williams. He's program director of psychology and director of the Psychological Clinic, University of Kansas. And Dr. John Sakalik, he is an assistant professor of psychology at Western University in Ontario. Gentlemen, in the article, you start with an alarming example of attachment therapy. And of course, this article is based on actual studies, right? There's actual science, and then you sort of built the article upon it. Who wants to speak to the study? And then let's segue into the example of Candace Newmaker. Can I start with you, Dr. Sakalik? I mean, set me up here, would you?
Yeah, so the study that we published in Clinical Psychology, Science and Practice that informed the Aon piece that we're talking about here was our attempt to grapple with the quality of scientific evidence that informs this discussion about potentially harmful therapies.
Dr. Botnov, I mean, when you ask someone, does it work? It just seems like a hugely subjective question. How do I determine if something worked in the subjective brain, you know?
That's a great question. And I think it fits well with sort of conceptualizing or putting in context what we're doing. And if I could just go one step back and say that generally speaking, when we start with the idea, what is psychotherapy? There's a world of what could potentially be therapeutic in this, right? Unmeasurable amount of things that could be therapeutic. We've now said, okay, we'll say psychotherapy. What is a therapeutic psychotherapy? So the world is full of treatments. I think you mentioned some at the beginning. You hear a lot of names, CBT, DBT, AC, ACT, not ACT, but and how do you define what is effective? So generally speaking, from a modern day psychological science perspective, we say, well, let's get some evidence, scientific evidence to do that. So now we're throwing away all people who just base it on their intuition, on their anecdotal experience. And we can have a whole podcast about just talking the difference between anecdotal intuition and compared to scientific evidence. And then we're open to this place. Okay, let's at least take treatments, psychotherapies that have been tested in a scientific way through randomized controlled trials. And we'll use that as evidence. And then what we want to do is we want to say, well, okay, well, we have these studies. My sort of way of saying it is not all evidence is created equal. There are quote unquote better and worse studies, or our word for this is more credible and less credible studies.
Go ahead.
And the last part there is that we were particularly interested in the credibility of studies that looked at potentially harmful therapies, which, as you can imagine, there's got to be a world of harmful things people do as well.
And we talk a lot about, I mean, this is not really what we're talking about today, but like the wellness industry, you know, this hugely unregulated space, often a very profitable space where people are promising all kinds of weird and amazing things using weird and amazing and often alarming practices, which brings me to Candace Newmaker, that you mentioned in the article an attachment therapy, which had dire consequences. Who would like to tell the story quickly of Candace Newmaker?
It's a tragic story. I mean, it is one of the worst things that could happen when we're talking about providing therapy, psychotherapy, treatment to somebody. This was a young girl who was adopted. Her mother was having lots of difficulties with the child, Candace. Behavioral difficulties, let's put it broadly that way. And she, unfortunately, the mom in this case, came upon this very controversial and potentially harmful therapy called attachment therapies. Now, attachment therapy is a broad term for a lot of different types of treatments or interventions. Things like forced hugging for an extended period of time, where the parent is told to hug their child no matter how much the child fights back, or laying on the child. Another type of attachment therapy is licking the child. And this particular type of treatment that was applied in this case was something called rebirthing therapy. And it's probably not already, I'm already giving away what it is. The idea is you reenact the birthing process. And even when I say it out loud, to me, it sounds wild that this is actually considered somehow theoretically plausible. And what they do is they cover you in blankets and pillows and sometimes with their own bodies to have you fight out of the womb, in a sense. In this case, this took, I forget the exact number at this point, but it took numerous hours. Poor Candace yelled, she cried, she pleaded for her life. She soiled herself. I believe she vomited. She provided all of the necessary signs to have this be stopped. And eventually, tragically, she was suffocated and died. She is not the only victim of rebirthing therapies. She might be the youngest and most severe case of that.
Well, this does not sound like something you would draw from the DSM. I mean, who came up with that? Was that just some sort of a subjectively assigned, extremely personal, quote unquote, therapy by this particular person?
So there are folks out there, therapists who practice the various forms of attachment therapy that Eugene was talking about. The psychotherapy industry is very unregulated. There are the vast majority of types of therapy that have ever been invented by some counselors, over 600 at least. Therapists are free to practice them regardless of the evidence of benefit or lack thereof, and regardless of the evidence of harm.
Dr. Sakalik, I want to put a punctuation mark that I'm not trying to sow distrust of the mental health profession, like science-based mental health. I mean, you'd agree, right? Where this largely is a beneficial thing that we encourage people going through crises to engage in, right? I mean, I'm not trying to scare anybody off. That's fair, right?
No. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think one of the important points to underscore here is that our best evidence now, again, there's this question of credibility, but our best evidence right now suggests that overwhelmingly bona fide psychotherapies work. Now, that's the rub. Like, what's a bona fide therapy from one of these kind of more sham therapies? And there's a whole spectrum right in between. So the best evidence that we have is that psychotherapy, bona fide psychotherapy, helps people in a lot of circumstances. But this kind of unregulated space does put the consumer in a bind where you have folks who are in distress, wanting to improve their lives, sometimes really needing a lot of extra help to do so. And those guardrails really aren't there to kind of protect their interests in terms of ensuring that they're able to opt into someone that is providing evidence-based care. I mean, if you're not able to kind of regulate that terminology, people see mental, like buzz terms like mental health, wellness, as you said, therapy, and they just say, okay, well, then if I do this, I'm going to get better. And it's a risk they take. And I think it's a risk they take oftentimes not knowing that they're taking a risk.
Well, it's hard for those of us who play out here in the civilian sandbox, you know, oh, they've got a PhD. And then I have to stop and think, well, you know, I think Deepak Chopra has a PhD. You know, Jordan Peterson, I think, has a PhD. Like, you know, this sort of degree mongering. So we're filtering through, well, who's legit, who has been sort of peer reviewed, who is in good standing in their profession. And I'm going to come back to that. I'll probably put that nearer the end of the conversation as a resource for people to go. You mentioned Scared Straight. Now, this is my generation. This was something that happened back in the 1980s, where they were trying to take these troubled teens who may have a predisposition based on their upbringing, circumstance, personality, whatever. They may turn to a life of crime. And so they came up with a rather radical method for keeping them on the straight and narrow. I would like any of you or all of you to speak to Scared Straight and why you consider it a bad therapy. Can I start? I guess I'll start with you. Dr. Williams, Scared Straight.
Yeah. So Seth, your summary there is correct, that essentially with Scared Straight, these were teenagers. In the studies that we reviewed, I believe they'd almost always already had some kind of run-in with the law. And the idea was that they were either going to go through the Scared Straight program, which is what you described, that they're going to go into a prison, interact with prisoners, and be exposed to the horrors of prison life. And then that will mean after that, that they won't be doing anything again. You know, they'll be perfectly law-abiding citizens after that. Versus other teenagers who had had run-ins with the law were randomly assigned to not get any intervention whatsoever. Just, okay, you know, they went to court and then that was it. In these cases, again, as you outlined, the idea was, oh, we'll scare them onto the straight and narrow. And that's not what happened. What was instead the case is that teenagers who went through the programs became more likely to become repeat offenders than teenagers who received no intervention whatsoever.
And Dr. Bodnoff, I remember they actually had a feature on local television about this. And it had all these warnings on it. You know, warning, what you're about to hear will feature harsh language. And they cut away to the inmates, often hardened felons. And they line these kids up against the wall and they bring in the biggest, most badass, scary looking dude. And he just berates them. He's screaming at them. Do you want to be here? Do you think this, you know, he just terrifying these people. Do I call that a form of psychological abuse? And we'd screw these kids up?
You ask a terrific question, Seth. I really appreciate that question. Because now you get to the question of, well, you're not sure. I guess our whole idea here is to measure the credibility of the evidence. But when you're not sure whether intervention will be therapeutic or vice versa, potentially harmful, you have to get back to the idea of what is the theory behind that treatment. So you could think of a very commonly known theory, CBT or cognitive therapy, where you're trying to change somebody's thoughts. This intervention, we wouldn't call this psychotherapy, we'd call this an intervention. This particular intervention, Scared Straight, is based on sort of this theoretical idea of tough love. And that's very easy for people to understand, right? So shockingly, getting teenagers yelling at them, verbally abusing them, scaring them is really not helpful, shockingly. And alternatively, it seems like it might actually be making things worse. So at the end of the day, your question becomes really that. Theoretically, it doesn't make much sense. It's based on a very outdated way of thinking. We have other types of tough love interventions that also don't seem to work. I might put boot camp under there as well. It's one of the ones we looked at. And in this
now,
case,
if I may, let me jump in. What do you mean by boot camp? Can you tell me what we're talking about there?
Sure. One of the interventions we looked at is something called boot camp interventions, which are not necessarily recidivism, somebody who committed a crime, but children who, always children or adolescents in this case, who get a military style type of a boot camp intervention where they literally go away to a camp of a sort. And they, in my head, I always imagined it as a basic training for the military. And again, you can understand why some people went off to basic training when they were 18 years old and really found structure and a benefit from basic training. Alternatively, you know, that is not a representative sample of human beings, right? And individuals, young people who have had some sort of difficulties in their life, what we're saying here is the idea is we need to provide tough love to make you better. And again, what we did, we simply said, let's look at the evidence. We're not saying yes or no. There's some evidence saying it might help. There's some evidence saying it might harm. We looked at the credibility of those different ends of that evidence spectrum and found that, especially with Scared Straight, the evidence seems to be more credible for harm rather than help.
It feels kind of intuitive, though. I mean, you send them to a place where they have to respond to, I don't know if it's guaranteed they will respect
authority in a healthy way, but certainly they have to abide by rules. They have structure. They have responsibilities. They have to set goals, meet goals, do chores, you know, those types of things. So, you know, and certainly in my earlier days, when I used to take more of a hard line about that tough love stuff, I would think, yeah, you know, show them what authority looks like. Make them walk the straight and narrow, which is, it's almost a binary way of looking at it, right? It's sort of a one size fits all. And it sort of leans scarily into a kind of authoritarianism. I don't know. Is that an overreaction when I talk about that? Like responding to authority with a capital A?
I would say the more important term you used was your intuition. And one of the things that we try to do as researchers, as psychological scientists, is not base our practices on intuition. And just to be clear, most people base their practice on intuition. Right. But if you're going out, let's take that very extreme case of Candace in that article we talked about. Do you want your 10-year-old child that you adopted to be getting a treatment based on intuition or based on your anecdotal experiences or based on superstition? I would say the vast majority of people would prefer some sort of scientific evidence. And so intuition is great. It's a great place to start, but then let's test it. And as the example we use in our article, this idea of cathartic treatments. So this one's out there, right? Punching a pillow will make you less angry. And we've had decades of research say, the more you punch a pillow, the more you're likely then later to punch human beings, punch walls. So punching just leads to more punching. Similarly, the evidence for tough love is just not there at the end of the day.
Dr. Williams, I'm going to throw that back to you. Come on. I've got pent-up anger, man. I got some rage. Well, I take it out on a human being. I can expend it, right? It's like the air that's sort of trapped in a balloon. I can expend my energy on an inanimate object that isn't going to care. That sounds healthy. You guys found that wasn't the case?
Well, so we didn't look at cathartic interventions like that exactly in our study, but in that we have reviewed that research before. I mean, certainly, if the alternative is punch a pillow or punch a human, my vote is punch the pillow. there may be more effective, you know, methods to pursue to help manage one's anger. The problem is what Eugene highlighted, that if you sit there and you punch the pillow, and let's say I just really go to town on it, you know, and I wail away, you know, a 3-minute round punching the pillow, at the end of it, I might feel tired. But in reality, the evidence is not that most people at that point experience, oh, I've released my anger. That's it. You know, Seth, as you mentioned, it seems very intuitive. Oh, that's how emotions work. I'll just have released it and I won't feel it anymore. But instead, it seems like then reality doing that simply begets more aggression and anger. So later in that day, again, maybe I'm tired out a bit, but as soon as I regain my energy, the anger is still there.
That's a tough sell. In a culture that seems to lean into, it's true because I feel it, because I distrust the man. You know, I distrust those scientists. Cue that sinister music. You know, you guys are all a bunch of mustache twirling people with your agendas back there, kind of deal. You know, Dr. Sakalik, do you have anything on that before I move on about this sort of release of anger, the pillow therapy? Anything we missed?
Yeah,
well, I'll just say Dr. Sakalik is a mustache twirling villain. So he probably has some unique insight here.
Well, and we can make a pillow for that occasion. I mean, just to release the tension in the room. Go ahead.
I actually used to have a pillow with the face of Dr. Williams on it, and make of that what you will. But no, I think one of the things that's being drawn out here in this conversation is it's not just therapists' intuitions about work that becomes a problem. You know, one of the things that I think we're talking around here is that a lot of times the labeling or the presumed mechanism that helps people is often something that plays to consumers' intuitions, right? You hear the word attachment therapy, and don't we think that attachment is good? I mean, obviously the extreme example of rebirthing, I think would get most people, you know, I hope it would get most people's hackles up, but like hugging, isn't hugging good, right? Don't we want people to be more huggable? You know, things like cathartic, right? Like getting your anger out, right? Isn't that something that just we feel is right? And that's part of the problem here is that I think consumers aren't necessarily what's aware in the scientific literature. That's not their fault. That's not their job. But a lot of these labels play to people's intuition about what would make them well or what could make someone well. And that's why getting into the data becomes so important. And I mean, to your point about the man and the mustache twirling scientist, you know, psychology hasn't had a great look going through this kind of credibility crisis in the last 10 years. But it's also the type of thing that is done in an attempt to instill confidence in the public, right? That we can hold ourselves accountable. We'll turn our methods back on our own products in an effort to call out what's weak sauce and identify what's, you know, a good, strong basis of evidence so that people can opt into therapies and feel confident that they're going to work for, you know, most people.
Yeah, John, but I mean, if you drag a soapbox, and we all have our biases and backgrounds and agendas, et cetera, let's say you drag a specific soapbox in that may not be in alignment with science-based mental health therapy. Are you policed by your own profession, or are you left to your own devices? Is this a culture that's pretty good at keeping itself accountable?
I think the answer is maybe it's both, in the sense that on the one hand, there's not a lot of strong regulation in, you know, this area. And so consumers do face this risk that folks can kind of do what, you know, shell what they want. And the protections there are perhaps not as strong as in other areas of health and wellness. On the other hand, there is a critical mass of folks that they work in and around universities. They go to these professional conferences. They have kind of collaborators that they, you know, do research with. And I do think that there is some kind of social accountability that happens in those communities that are science-based. And, you know, Dr. Williams and Dr. Botnov could certainly tell you more. I'm not the type of psychologist that does or provides therapy. But the kinds of psychologists that do, there are structures that promote them going back and getting more training and staying connected to a scientific community. And there is some hope that through that type of process, accountability is there to be had, at least to some degree, so that folks aren't just offering any old thing that pops into their head.
Yeah, Dr. Botnov, I mean, I guess I could call myself a naturopathic doctor of psychology and hang my shingle and go out and just, you know, charge people $300 an hour to, say, enhance your calm and play Yanni music, you know. And it must frustrate the hell out of you to see people who are, even if they're not cashing in, they're not rooting themselves in the science, right? I mean, it must drive you crazy.
You get to a very critical issue here. What drives?
Well, you know, I'm just that kind of interviewer. I ask the probing questions. I'm just saying. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, out of the whole world of research to do, why are we doing research that purposely is going to make people upset at us, right? We are literally going to say some of these treatments are, in some of our work, either not effective or harmful, or they're not credible yet. So for me, it's not about other people cashing in. For me, it is the idea of a canvas. And we don't have to be even that severe. The idea of somebody that needs help getting some sort of ineffective treatment, some sort of pseudoscientific treatment, or even worse, a harmful treatment. And it's much easier to put it that way when you could think of somebody in your life that's been depressed, that's been anxious, that's had difficulty with a child, that's had bipolar disorder, right? And if you're saying, hey, we want to help this person, and the sea of options are sort of like playing, I don't even know what game to say. It's like rolling the dice. Good luck finding somebody that A, is doing something effective, B, not doing something harmful, right? So that's really what drives this research and why we do this kind of work.
Well, this is tangential to therapy, but there's the whole business of commercialized cuddling where people charge, you know, they say, hey, if you pay me money, I'll cuddle with you. And I've kind of railed about some of that practice before. The thing is, though, I mean, I'm very pro if consenting adults want to do that, by all means, go for it. I'm the, you know, commercialized cuddling industry's best friend when, you know, in that regard. But my issue, though, is the type of thing that Eugene brought up there. The idea that when you begin saying, hey, if you pay me money to cuddle with you, it will help your depression. It will help your clinical anxiety. It will help your bipolar disorder, your obsessive compulsive disorder. Now you're selling people snake oil. You're telling them that you're going to help their mental health with a clinical, you know, mental health diagnosis. You're going to be helping them out without evidence at all for those claims. And I think that's what tends to get, you know, consenting adults should be free to do kind of what they want here, but not when we're talking about desperate people who are being sold a bill of goods about their mental health diagnosis and that this will help them.
People will pay money for a cuddle?
People will pay money for a cuddle.
And do they take American Express? Because
I've got a...
No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. Just commercial cuddling is a concept I had not been aware of. By the way, I am talking to three very special guests. I've got Dr. Eugene Botnov, licensed clinical psychologist and professor, Dr. Alexander Williams, who is director of psychology at the University of Kansas, and Dr. John Sakalik. He is also a psychologist over at Western University, Ontario. Is it true that if I see someone who has gone through trauma and I bring them into PTSD therapy, one, they may not actually have PTSD. Two, my therapy might be causing them to have PTSD. I was reading about this in the article. I know it's complex. Can we talk about PTSD, good and bad therapies?
Yeah, I'll maybe take the first question about, is it possible that they might not have PTSD? Now, not using, just leaving PTSD aside for a moment, in this whole credibility conversation, one of the themes of discussion has been around, well, how do we measure or assess these psychological states and these psychological problems like depression, like PTSD, like bipolar disorder, and so on. And one of the problems that's been identified there is, depending on the disorder, you may actually have many dozens of different ways of kind of defining what is depression. For example, there's a very well-known research psychologist, Eiko Fried, who's done great work in this area, that, you know, there's over 52 different symptoms that have been used to define the presence of depression, and different psychological instruments draw on different combinations of those symptoms. And so how do you know that you're talking apples to apples? You know, if one person has been diagnosed based on one measure, how do you know that's going to stand up to the next? So that is something that a lot of people are thinking about. Now, our work isn't quite focused on critically evaluating those assessment tools. It is very much focused on, as you say, that second question of certain types of treatments that are intended to help with PTSD. What is the state of evidence for? How effective are those? And how credible is the research underlying that area?
I guess maybe if I was to simplify the question, then are we addressing a problem that may not exist? And if it exists, are we making it worse? I don't know. I mean, Dr. Williams, you got anything on that?
Yes. So Seth, you've hit on something that I will frequently get on my soapbox about, the use of trauma broadly and outside of psychology. People use the phrase, I experienced a trauma, to mean all kinds of different things. And that's fine. Psychologists don't own the word trauma. So people will say, if they went through a breakup, it was traumatic. I had a bad day at work. It was traumatic. You know, TikTok videos use trauma to mean lots of different things. So that's great. But within psychology, trauma means something particular when it comes to like the DSM. And so a psychological trauma in that sense is when somebody is nearly killed themselves, when they witness somebody else being killed or nearly killed, when they experience a sexual assault, or a few other types of categories. So for instance, somebody who works with human remains frequently, or a first responder who's frequently encountering people who may be in various states of dying or nearly dying. So that's a psychological trauma from the perspective of the DSM. Even within that kind of narrow subset of how people use the phrase trauma, most people who experience a psychological trauma don't go on to have a lasting mental health problem from it. It doesn't mean that you're weak or deficient or to blame if you do, but it's worth acknowledging that the research indicates most people don't experience lasting mental health problems. So yes, I do think it's a problem. And if we begin saying anyone who experiences a psychological trauma needs an intervention, that is part of one of the treatments that we found credible evidence that causes harm is critical incident stress debriefing, sometimes called psychological debriefing. And it's premised on the idea that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, which is a lot of times is true, but not here. that anyone who's experienced a psychological trauma can benefit from immediately receiving an intervention to help try to guard against the developing of further psychological problems. And instead, what the evidence suggests, and we found that the evidence is pretty credible in this regard, is that getting that intervention on average makes people's mental health worse than receiving no intervention at all. Maybe because you're kind of compelling people to talk about the traumatic event before they're ready to, but regardless of the exact mechanism, it's harmful, that it's likely making people's mental health worse compared to, again, if following a trauma, they received no immediate intervention at all.
Interesting subjective application of terms in the culture. I know a clinical psychologist who works with people who've come out of military conflicts who really do have that specific and severe form of PTSD, which is different than, oh, I have PTSD because my boss yelled at me today, you know, and I'm not trying to dismiss people who go through some kind of a social trauma, but, you know, it does seem to be kind of a moving target. I don't know. More on this, Dr. Botnoff, did you want to jump in?
I wanted to add this component. As Alex mentioned, the vast majority of people will go through a traumatic experience. What we even diagnostically would consider a traumatic experience, the vast majority of those individuals will not develop PTSD. A portion, and for anybody interested, the most likely traumatic event to lead to PTSD is actually sexual trauma. So it's roughly 50-50 in that case. The thing about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is a disorder that cannot be diagnosed until a month has passed. It is a very normal human thing to experience problems after a severe car accident, after some sort of deadly experience, completely normal. What's abnormal is for those symptoms to keep going for a long time after the event. So now you start avoiding places, avoiding things, situations, right? And so this particular intervention, psychological debriefing or critical incident stress debriefing, the theoretical background is, well, if we get in there before things get bad, we can fix it. However, again, this goes back to the same idea of what is the theory here? It also seems like if you get in there before, you can accidentally lead to PTSD. And one of the things that leads to PTSD is people thinking about the event too much or perseverating or ruminating about the event too much. And we're not talking about the ideas like, hey, I want to go potentially talk about this with somebody, forcing people to talk about it, for example, which I think is an older model for this treatment. I think they tried to get away from that. Forcing people to talk about something when they don't want to talk about it, that is likely theoretically there. Unhelpful, let's say, and potentially harmful.
More with my special guest talking about bad therapies. I want to get into this whole idea of religious therapy, specifically getting into the just terrible conversion therapy for LGBT people and beyond that. What happens when superstition infects psychology? We'll ask some psychologists on the other side of this. Lots of speaking dates on the calendar. It's good to be back on the road. I would love to see you. Nashville, Tennessee. That's coming up July 30th for NanoCon. I'll be in Lubbock, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Minneapolis, Ontario, and more. All those details, thethinkingatheist.com/events. Talking here with Dr. John Sakalik, Dr. Alexander Williams, and Dr. Eugene Botnoff, psychologist who've been doing some work on bad therapies. What happens when the mental health profession does more harm than good? Let me throw this out. We can skip it if you want. Religious therapies for things like LGBT people. And this is my background. I came out of a fundy faith. I am no longer of a fundy faith. But we see these just insidious conversion therapy models where people walk in and they have declared that non-heterosexuality is some sort of aberration that must be fixed. It is, is it a mental illness or sin or whatever? And then they prescribe these systems, these boot camps, these often terrifying programs to fix people who are not broken. Who wants to take this one, if anybody? Conversion therapy.
I'll maybe take some of that and feel free to poke around and follow up. I mean, I think in present day, I think a lot of folks who are on the right side of evidence acknowledge that conversion therapies are in many ways actively harmful. What's some interesting kind of historical context is even some of the early proponents of the quote unquote science behind conversion therapies have since kind of acknowledged that all was not well in the way that you know, that science was being conducted. For example, Robert Spitzer, I believe his name is, was one of those people, and on his deathbed actually published an article that basically lamented his involvement in the whole thing and said, this is not good. We should not be doing this. So my understanding is, and I'll look to Eugene and Alex for confirmation here, but that the APA has basically taken a hardline stance that, like, all conversion therapy is harmful and should not be done. You're starting to see conversion therapy bans emerge in different countries. So, for example, I do believe, I could be wrong here, but I do believe that in Canada, actually, we have a federal ban on anything that would be considered conversion therapy.
Oh, yeah. I heard someone say the other day, as you are in Ontario, they said, you know, the Canadians must feel like they live in an apartment over a meth lab. And I thought, you know, that's probably pretty accurate. I mean, things are insane.
Did you see what happened in our capital, a couple of months ago? we are looking so hot these days, Seth.
Oh, great. Great. That's all Seth. We need. I know, I'm looking north for sanity. And what do you give? Yeah. Go ahead. Jump in.
No.
I want to reiterate some of the points John made to go to your question. Conversion therapy or reparative therapy, or I think the term nowadays is sexual orientation change therapy, is really the catch-all term for this. It has a really interesting history. And it started off, as most of the treatments we talk about, with a desire to help you. Homosexuality was a diagnosis. This was a diagnosis. And people came to therapists saying, I'm experiencing so much problems because of this. Help me, right? That's how Candace's story starts. That's how almost everybody's story starts when they get to mental health treatment. And there are people who want to help. And that's how the history of these therapies began. People who were trying to help. What we figured out afterwards is, and what a lot of people don't understand when they talk about particularly this newer issue of the disorder we say is typically gender identity dysphoria or something to that effect is, what they understood is it's not that the person has a problem that needs to be fixed. The person is experiencing distress in relation to what's happening in society. And a disorder doesn't mean you have a problem necessarily. A disorder is purely in the context of what's happening in the world. Soon after, the psychologists who originally started the idea of applying very traditional behavioral therapy will reinforce you for having heterosexual interests, will punish you for having non-heterosexual interests, realize this, and they stop. Soon after that, psychiatry got it out of the book. And it's a fascinating story. I won't go into here. And at that point, once the traditional venues of treating problems said, these are not disorders, these are almost normal reactions to society, that is when religious groups picked it up. And that's when you started having these camps, as you mentioned, take on this. For us, we never looked at this term treatment, simply for the fact that there are no randomized controlled trials. There are no clinical trials on this type of treatment. So one of our rate limiting factors in the work we do is we can only look at things that people have scientifically studied. This particular treatment, the anecdotal evidence and the non-controlled evidence is so strong in favor of harm, there's not, and without any evidence of efficacy at all, any legitimate evidence of efficacy, let's say anyway, that nobody goes on to do research on them. So we have sort of this, you always have to think about evidence in this way. We have enough evidence without doing studies, controlled trials, to say this is harmful. The other treatments, like the things we're talking about, scared straight, psychological debriefing, we'll probably, I'm sure, get to DARE. There we have studies that want to say there is, it's much harder to tell. Is it helpful? Is it harmful? And that's the kind of work we're looking to make clear for the, not, and just to be clear, for other researchers, for clinicians, and for the public.
Dr. Williams, before we put a punctuation mark on it, you wanted to jump in, I see.
Yeah, just a kind of a summative comment that I think that there's an unfortunate and long history in the United States of harm and therapy towards folks and the LGBTQ plus community. and or ethno-racial minority individuals. And the therapy community has improved in some ways in this regard, and there are still many ways in which therapy can improve.
Seth, if you're interested, I have a pretty amazing quote from Spitzer's lamenting article where he kind of walks back his conversion therapy piece, if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, please.
So Robert Spitzer, who was a medical doctor, for example, published in 2003 an article on Can Some Gay Men and Lesbians Change Their Sexual Orientation? Later in 2012, pretty soon before he died, Spitzer reassesses his 2003 study, and the article ends with, "I believe I owe the gay community an apology for my study, making unproven claims of the efficacy of reparative conversion therapy. I also apologize to any gay person who wasted time and energy undergoing some form of reparative therapy because they believed that I had proven that reparative therapy works with some highly motivated individuals." So to me, there you have it right from the horse's mouth.
That's a great example of science sort of sharpening its own knives. You know, it took them a while to get there, but that's a step in the right direction. Final thoughts from any or all of you? I want to talk, bad agency and bad therapy versus the good. How can someone maybe find a resource to know the difference? Anybody want to start?
I just want to add one last thing there.
Go ahead.
Really relevant to, I think, your podcast in general. The idea here is the reason we do science, broadly speaking, is because the scientific endeavor is in itself self-fixing, maybe is the best way. I can't think of a better word right now.
Self-policing, or would that be accurate?
There's a good word that's not coming to my mind right now.
Self-correcting?
Self-correcting, thank you. Self-correcting. In the face of mounting evidence, disconfirming what you originally thought, the scientific community, maybe slowly sometimes, will turn the ship. Alternative perspectives to having evidence, which are the proponents of these types of sexual orientation change therapies or a lot of the other harmful therapies. When they're not using a scientific approach, you're not getting the evidence. You're not looking for the evidence. You're only looking to confirm what you believe. And this is why we do the work we do. We're hoping to change people's minds with these kinds of studies, these kinds of reassessments of previous research. What we're doing is we're applying the scientific method to the science that's being used. And there, I'll put a stop there.
No, I get that. I mean, it's a great point. I saw somebody say the other day that if a scientist proves another scientist wrong, you may get a Nobel Prize. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church heard Galileo say that we aren't the center of the universe and they put him in prison. You know, it's just that kind of challenge. I'd like each of you to kind of, put a punctuation on our discussion. I'm going to put a link to the article in the description box. Can I start with you, Dr. Williams? Any final thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, Seth, you asked about how people can find a provider who is helpful, non-harmful. My general advice there is, one, they can take some comfort statistically, as we mentioned earlier, that most therapists providing therapy, if you're somebody who wants therapy, you're going to a therapist, most likely therapy is going to help, not harm. Now, to be in that category, though, of, let's get some more certainty, if you're going to a therapist, I think asking the therapist what the evidence is for their treatment, and if the only evidence is, well, I've been doing this for years, and everyone who's I've worked with, I think, has gotten better. That's great to hear. I'd be a little skeptical of that, actually, because that's a little too confident. But we want to see some scientific evidence, too. I think the other thing is you can ask them, how will we keep track of whether or not I'm getting better? So listeners to this podcast are probably aware of the human memory is fallible. And so if we want to make sure somebody's getting better and not getting worse, it's important to consider how that's going to be tracked in therapy. Many listeners may be familiar with the experience of going to a doctor's office and filling out just something called the PHQ-9, but just a quick screener of depressive symptoms. Even something like that, something you fill out in 30 seconds that helps keep track of some symptoms of depression from the last 2 weeks, periodically doing that is probably better than just never doing any sort of measurement other than relying on the therapist to tell you whether they think you're doing better or not. So asking the therapist what the evidence is for the treatment and how we keep track of whether I'm getting better in therapy.
Alex, your screen froze temporarily. Fortunately, it froze on, a very pleasing pose. You look very peaceful and serene. You're centered, your chakras are all aligned or whatever. But just if anybody was watching.
That's what's important.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. If you walk into a therapist office and they've got like incense and light, blue light and crystals and, you know, the Maharishi over here, you know, you may want to keep looking. Dr. Sakalic, you want to tell me your final thought on all of what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I would say we haven't actually talked too much about what are some of those telltale signs of, shall we say, incredible or uncredible research. And a lot of them are very technical, but there are a couple that I think, you know, your listeners that are more interested in going into the literature themselves and maybe poking around and seeing what they can see might find useful as kind of heuristics for determining, hey, is this believable or is this too good to be true? And the two that I would offer kind of come to us across the span of our work where we've looked at some treatments that are kind of questionable and potentially harmful. We've looked at some other therapies that are like gold standard. These are the first kind of order therapies that we roll out. And we've seen kind of at least two themes emerge from that. One heuristic that your listeners could use in evaluating the research themselves, or, you know, if someone was looking to find a therapist and looking into a therapy, look at the sample sizes of those clinical trials, right? You don't need to be a rocket scientist or a psychological scientist to understand that more data often leads to better decisions, right? And better evidence. And so all else being equal, put your faith in trials for therapies that have large groups of people recruited to participate in them. Some therapies, for example, they have a number of trials published, but those trials are really small. You know, in some of our work, we saw trials with like 10 or 20 people, and you just can't learn that much from those types of studies. The second thing that I would point to is look at what the comparison is for a given therapy, right? If someone's trying to sell you on the benefits of newfangled therapy X, what is it being compared against? What is, you know, how is it being evaluated in terms of its performance? And what we've seen is that the cream of the crop, they get compared against the very best, right? It's like, you know, we just saw the NBA finals, you know, you had the Boston Celtics going up against Steph Curry's Golden State Warriors. And that's how we know the Golden State Warriors are really great, because they beat a great team. What you see in a lot of these literatures is therapies that you want to avoid, they shy away from strong competition. They don't want to be compared against other strong therapies. They want to seek out, hey, let's compare this to just waiting around or nothing at all, or whatever you're doing that's not already working, right? And so paying attention to those two things as a critical consumer of psychotherapy: how big are the trials, and are those therapies seeking out strong competition? If the trials are small or the competition's weak sauce, those are good signals to maybe avoid those forms of psychotherapy.
Dr. Bodnoff, resources and final thoughts?
I think it's important, if we're trying to help people, to base this on a type of evidence that has the greatest utility. And the greatest utility seems to be from this perspective, where we are testing things, collecting data, information, usually quantitative information, to show this works better than that. That's an important way to assess whether something will help. Whether things will harm is much harder to figure out. And when we talk about, we've been very, I would say, political and safe about it. We're talking about potentially harmful therapies. We're talking about things that have stronger evidence for their harm. But to really get at these issues, we need to keep supporting research. We have to keep doing more research. And then as a consumer, and even for if you have practitioners that listen to you, you need to be constantly introspective. Am I doing something that I have evidence works? Am I doing something that, if somebody says it's harmful, let me see, what is the evidence for that? And I say that both to, again, the consumer getting the treatment and the people providing it.
All right, gentlemen. I've got a big thank you, by the way, to Dr. Eugene Bodnoff and Dr. Alexander Williams and Dr. John Sakalic. I'll let you guys go back to your evil scientist lair and twirl your mustaches and do what you do. And I will link that article, which I found fascinating and I find very, very helpful. It's just a nice injection of reason into this often unreasonable world. I think we're all susceptible. We kick into the quick fix, or somebody's got a lab coat or a PhD, or they just seem credible. And so our intuitions say, go and trust this person. And I appreciate your reliance and encouragement to follow the science. and let science sharpen itself. All three of you gentlemen, thanks so much for your time and expertise. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Seth.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.